STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, my dear friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. And missed last week. I thank you for your patience on that. We've got a few weeks coming up where it's going to be like that. Next week I'll be here, but then I'll be on vacation with my family. Actually, last week was supposed to be last time out, was supposed to be some vacation for me on my own up at our cabin. I did get to go up there, but since I have not finished the book yet, I spent the bulk of the time writing, which was fine because my first week, it snowed. And the second week, it just got so blissfully warm, it would have been perfect fishing weather. But I'm so committed to this project, I just stuck with my book. I put my boat up and my tackle up until I come back in a couple of weeks with my family. I could hurry this project along and produce something substandard, and I just can't do that. And I know I'm behind my schedule, and everybody would like me to finish, including my staff and my editor. And I'm almost done, but the last chapter is the hardest chapter. I mean, think about it for a moment. If you're writing a book about the Christian worldview, telling the Christian story, and this book is called The Story of Reality, and the subtitle is How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. And the structure, the backbone of the story, follows five words: God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection. God being the beginning, final resurrection being the ending. Man being created, then falls, then Jesus, God becomes a man to rescue fallen man, and what he does in his life and in his death on a cross determines what happens in the final resurrection. God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection. So you see the continuity there, and it gives the big picture, and it gives detail as well. And what I've tried to do is weave in apologetics in a painless way, in a way that doesn't feel like it's an apologetics book. I'm taking my cues largely from C.S. Lewis and Mere Christianity. Indeed, I read from Mere Christianity or listen to a British person reading it. Every time I sit down to write, to try to get a voice there and a feel of flow of a way of conversing with the writer. And here I am in my final chapter, which I title Perfect Mercy. The one before it is Perfect Justice, and that's about judgment, and the final one is Perfect Mercy. And this is meant to capture what it will be like for us to experience the perfect mercy, not just the forgiveness of sins, but the wonder that follows. And this is something that Lewis talks about actually frequently. In the last battle, he speaks of it in Mere Christianity, speaks of it in Weight of Glory, he speaks of it, but he always speaks of it in these, I'm trying to find the right word. He says, you know, streets of gold, that doesn't do anything for him. And it's not really about that. It's about something else. And then in his singular way, he's able to speak of the wonder of that which follows. The last chapter there, the last battle in the Chronicles of Narnia, is really the first chapter, and it's just the beginning, and every chapter after that is written is better than the one before. And this is kind of a way he tries to capture the wonder of the resurrection. So I'm in that section, and I'm trying to, and I'm laboring, with trying to do it justice without sounding corny or without sounding shallow. And it's a challenge for me. Now, something that is, this is why it's taken the time that it's taken. Now, I have a short show today. I'm just doing 1 hour, and I'm doing 1 hour because I have to leave and go to LAX and get in an airplane for Norway. And I'll be gone for a week, all told. I'll be back for next week's broadcast, but I will have just gotten back. and the night before. And so I can only talk to you for one hour, but I'm going to be using some of my time on the plane to labor more on this chapter. And there was I might have offered it here on the show once before, I'm not sure, but I read something in Bunyan, in the introduction, John Bunyan's book. And I always, whenever I say John Bunyan, I pause and I'm thinking, is that the lumberjack from Wisconsin? No, that's Paul Bunyan. Okay, the John Bunyan. I got to get these first names right. So John Bunyan's book, Pilgrim's Progress, has in front of it, at least the edition that we have, and that I'm reading to our girls now and again, has a longish poem in it that talks about the process of writing the book. And there is a couplet in there that I saved, and I've actually read it so many times I've memorized it, and it has helped me tremendously in my writing. And here's what he says about the task and the ordeal of a writer and how his task is accomplished. That's what it amounts to. And here's what he said. He said, "Still, as I pulled, it came. And so I penned it down until at last it came to be for length and breadth this bigness that you see. Still, as I pulled, it came. And so I penned it down." And boy, I read that over and over and remind myself that writing is pulling. You sit there and you pull at your mind and you pull at your language and you pull at your words and you pull at the text and you pull at the ideas and you just keep pulling. And little by little, you're pulling a little bit more out. And so I penned it down until at last it comes to be for length and breadth this bigness, God willing, this bigness that you will see when it's finally done. So I am laboring at this enterprise and am very, very happy of what I have so far. I started out with a contract that said 30 to 40,000 words because I thought in dealing with this material that used to be called Credo, C-R-E-D-O, in dealing with that, I thought, boy, I don't know if I can get 40,000 words. Let's just say 30 to 40, and I'll do my best to fill that bill. Right now, I'm at about 52,000. And still counting. So it looks like the book will be closer to 60, twice as much as what I was committed for, but I think more of what Zondervan wanted, and about the length of the tactics book. But I didn't want to write something that was long and cumbersome. I wanted to write something short and to the point. However, the way I've written, I think the conversational style, the way I really try to talk with the reader, instead of talk about information, I think this stretches the word count out a little bit, but makes it much more accessible. I have my 11-year-old reading passages just to make sure they pass her muster. And if she can follow the flow and it's easy for her without being patronizing, then I think I've accomplished at least one goal that I wanted to accomplish. And that is write in a way that's going to be really accessible to a lot of people. I'm kind of doing in this book something like what Lewis did 70 years ago now in Mere Christianity, which I think that was published in 1950, so 65 years ago or so, and 66. And try to do that, though I blush even suggesting a comparison because there is no comparison with Lewis, but in that he is covering ground that is foundational stuff, and he covers a whole bunch of stuff that I don't get to, but I do want to cover these foundational things in a way that's accessible to the rank and file so that not only can you, the listener, you who's listening, follower of Christ, disciple of Christ, have parts of your Christian worldview kind of filled in so you get the full picture, but also people who are beginners can get the full picture in a way they can grasp. And this, I hope, is the kind of book that many, many people are going to give to their non-Christian friends because I think this tells the story in a way that they will understand it because it does not trade on religious jargon. And not only will they understand it, but I hope it's compelling. And that's where these little apologetic elements are slipped in. And so now I'm on that final chapter. When I finish that, there'll be an epilogue that kind of sums everything up, but that'll be shorter. So I'm probably about 5,000 words away from the final form. And everything that I've done up to now has already been passed off by the editor. It's all clean and ready to go. So I just got to finish up this last one and a half chapters, really. So thank you for your patience. And I was glad to have the time last week, not fishing, but writing in front of my fire and by the stove there. It was just, it was great. So that's where I was then. Now I have a piece in front of me I want to say something about very briefly, because I kind of think this kind of stuff is going to come up more and more. For a long time, the whole issue of same-sex marriage and homosexuality was that so much in the news that we had to address it on a fairly frequent basis, though I was very happy to get away to other issues. And now, in the last year, something else has taken center stage since SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States of America, made their decision last June, just about a year ago, on same-sex marriage. It's like that has just fallen completely out of the news cycle. Pardon me. And instead, now something else has taken its place. And where it took the same-sex marriage issue something like 8 or 9 years to ramp up to this major thing, this new issue wasn't even really even on the charts a year ago, and now it's everywhere. And the new issue is the whole issue of transgendered people, which represent a minute fraction of the population of this country. And that is not to say that their concerns should be dismissed or they should, in a sense, anyway be mistreated. But no one has ever suggested such a thing. What is happening now is this is the new beleaguered class. And I've never put it like that before, but now that's a good phrase. It's the new beleaguered class. That's a good way of putting it. They're the ones that people who are looking for a cause célèbre, some new thing to latch onto, to make a big fuss about and pass laws about that are contrary to common sense. This is their new thing, their new cause célèbre. And particularly it is, we want to make sure that people who identify themselves with a gender other than their physical gender are allowed to have access to those places, any of those places that are consistent with their gender identity, not their physical gender. So that means that the male physical body can be in a female physical body bathroom, okay, and shower with the female physical bodies too, where those physical bodies shower in public places, whether schools or gyms or spas or whatever, you know, because we must be sensitive to the way they feel. Now, of course, this is a complete sham because nobody cares about sensitivity here, because if they did, they would be caring about the sensitivity of all, for example, all of those young ladies that are mortified at the idea that they have to share the bathroom or the shower with a person who is, for all practical purposes, the opposite sex. What they see is not what their mind thinks. What they see is what their body is. And so there is no real care about the feelings of people, because that would be the thing that would matter. The majority of people whose feelings are being violated because they think their privacy is being violated, and in some senses, some cases, and I'm speaking reality here, their safety is being compromised, because there is no way to monitor this. You don't show a doctor's note that says, I have a female gender identity so I can go into this shower with the women. You don't have a doctor's note to that. No one's supposed to ask about that, because that's further encumbrance. And so this is about political correctness. It's not about being kind and gracious. So what this means then is you're going to see all kinds of things come down the pike that have to do with transgender issues now, where, again, this minuscule fraction of the population is taking center stage. And even the most reasonable legislation that is attempted to be passed to provide and acknowledge the sensitivities of transgendered people, but at the same time acknowledge the need for privacy and safety of those who are not. Those most reasonable kind of legislation is being utterly mischaracterized and then shot down and vetoed by governors who don't have the how can I put this delicately? I'll just say the guts, okay? They don't have the guts to do what's good and right for their constituency. Instead, they're pushed around by Hollywood and sports teams who say, we're not going to play sports in your state, and Disneyland and all that other stuff. And consequently, they don't do what's right. They do what's wrong, but they garb it. They clothe it in righteous language. There's a lot more of this going to be coming up, okay? So I have an article here right now, and I'm not going to read it this segment because I have a caller on the line I want to get to in just a moment. But I may get to later in the show. But it's called Jesus, the First Transgender Man. And this kind of Jesus, the First Transgender Man, I've already read it, most of it, and it's not very long, but it's just, oh, here we go. Here we go. It's kind of like the distorted what would Jesus do approach. Jesus would bake the cake. Jesus would do the flowers, you know, when it comes to the question of whether the bakers who are Christians, whether they should participate in a same-sex ceremony or not. No, we don't want to do that. Well, Jesus would bake the cake. He would give the flowers. He would take the photos. He would participate. That's what Jesus would do. And then there's some twisted kind of argument given to press Jesus into service for this nonsense. And now the same thing is happening here. Jesus, the first transgendered man. So maybe in a bit I will get to the specifics here, but I'm just putting you on notice. This is coming down the pike. We're going to get more of this. And again, we're almost consumed by it now. Something that wasn't even on the radar, really, as a main event 1 year ago, which makes me wonder what's going to happen 1 year from now. Do you see how odd this is becoming? How strange everything is getting? And what was extreme yesterday is ordinary today. And I'm sorry, is not believable yesterday is believable today and ordinary and commonplace tomorrow. That was Francis Schaeffer. What next? I saw a clever little thing that I have a friend. Most friends don't send me this stuff, and I'm glad you don't. Very few who have my email, but I do have a friend that sends me a few of these funny little things from sometimes political things, sometimes just social things. They get passed around, and this one had a picture of John Kennedy and Barack Obama. And underneath the picture of John Kennedy, it says, "We will put a man on the moon," which he said in 1963, and within, 6 years, he'd accomplished that. Well, I mean, his vision was fulfilled, but he was killed later after he said this. But this is, he says, "We will put a man on the moon," and there's Barack Obama. "We will put a man in a woman's bathroom." This is what has come to. How frivolous and foolish this has become. Anyway, you're in for a lot more, and who knows what else. Okay, well, we still do our job. We still fulfill our commission in spite of the nonsense and the foolishness. Be back in just a moment with your calls. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's mentoring letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STRE News from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
Carry STR with you by downloading our Stand to Reason and Quick Reference apps for free. Both are available for iPhone, iPad, and Android. From your STR app, listen to the weekly podcast, speaker podcasts, check out the STR blog, access Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and more. The Quick Reference app gives you the tools you need to answer the toughest questions Christians face, all through the easy-to-read text and short videos. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. And they're free, so download the apps today and start carrying STR with you everywhere you go.
Greg Kogel back with you here, giving you a piece of my mind as I do, well, I usually say every week, but I've had some absences and will have some coming up, but had great people filling in for me, and you'll see that here at the beginning of the summer when I'm gone. We got a great team. We had a very deep bench at Stand to Reason, so you can look forward to sharing with them and having them share with you and raising your questions with them as well. I have Jeff in Minnesota on. Jeff just flew out of Minneapolis a couple of days ago. Where do you live in Minnesota?
St. Bonnie, which is about 5 or 6 suburbs straight west of Minneapolis.
Oh, okay. So you're in the greater Minneapolis area there.
Just beyond Lake Minnetonka.
Yeah. Wow, great. I fished that lake. It's a good bass lake. It's huge.
It is huge.
It just sprawls all over. So I love that country. I envy you, during when the ice is out, I envy you that live in Minnesota. I'm not too fond of your winters, though, but boy, do you have a lot of opportunities for the kind of thing I love to do but don't get much time to do it, fish. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, glad you called, and I know you called in earlier, and we put you off an hour, so I'm glad to have you back on board. How can I help you?
Yeah. My question is regarding Job 1, and this question stems from a discussion a buddy and I had about spiritual warfare, and essentially it sounds like people fall into two camps in terms of opinion of what Satan can or can't do in the physical world, and the question really came down to, does Job 1 give evidence that Satan can manipulate things in the physical world? A buddy of mine said, gave an example where someone will say, well, his truck broke down, and someone says, oh, see, there's Satan. He doesn't want you to do this or that.
Mm-hmm.
I've read Job umpteen times, of course, and I went back and read it and reread it, and suddenly I'm not so sure who's doing the action to Job. And so there's two verses that seem to be conflicting each other. I wanted to get your take on that. So verse 11 says, Satan's posing a challenge to God and says, but now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face.
Okay.
And then in the very next
verse... This is the conversation between Satan and God, and God is saying how great Job is, and Satan is saying, yeah, he's doing well because he's got everything he wants, but if you take that away from him, you strike him, then he's not going to be so faithful as you thought. That's kind of
right.
The nature of the conversation here.
Perfect. And God says, okay, you're on.
Mm-hmm.
So verse 12, he says, very well then, everything he has is in your power. But then you look at the things that happen to Job, and there's it breaks it down into 4 separate things. 2 of them, you have people who are living near Job attack and kill his servants and take his stuff. One of them, the fire of God fell and burns up more of his flock and the servants. And finally, the last one, severe winds strike and knock his house down and kill all his sons and daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And then Job's response is, well, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm I guess my at first blush, I come away with the impression that, yes, Satan has made the challenge, but ultimately it was God that made the wind blow, that made the fire fall, and all these, and made the Sabaeans and Chaldeans come and take all his stuff.
Well, am
I reading that right?
Well, I think this is a complex interplay here between God's providence and individual acting, and the individual here being Satan. I'm looking at for the passage where you said that God sent the fire. Do you have that in hand? Quickly here.
I'm just working off crib notes. It'd be somewhere between 11 and 21.
Of chapter 1?
Chapter 1.
Okay. Oh, the fire of God. Oh, while he was still speaking, also said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Okay, now, my general take on this is that what Satan challenges God, and he says, God, if you strike Job, Job will deny you. And what God says, okay, I will let you strike him. And then Job then strikes him. Satan then strikes Job and does these different things, although it does appear in verse 16, it says the fire of God fell from heaven and burned. But that's not a description of what happened. That is a person saying what he thinks happened.
Okay,
so the text isn't instructing us that God was the one who sent the fire. Rather, we have the messenger who came and says, quote, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned upon the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Okay? So I don't necessarily conclude from that he was speaking accurately, that God sent the fire. He is just describing it as the fire of God. Who does he know? Where does he know it comes from? He doesn't know. So he's just saying that. So I would take this whole text then as God providentially giving Satan the access to Job, in a certain sense, removing the protection that he might have been giving Job, so Satan can act. But I think clearly in these other examples, the fire of God may be ambiguous, but clearly in the others, it seems like Satan is the one who is the agent of the calamity. But God is the one who allowed it to happen, which is why his wife says, curse God and die, because if God wouldn't have allowed it, it wouldn't have happened. So she's putting the blame on him. And then Job says in chapter 2, verse 10, shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? So Job understands the providential role of God over all of this, even though there is an evil individual that is propagating the problem. And this happens in our own lives. Leave the angelic realm out for a moment, like Satan, where there could be bad that someone does to us that is still under the providential hand of God. I think of Squanto. I don't know if you know the story of Squanto.
Yeah, I heard about a year ago you had an author on about it.
Yeah, so we talked about an account that was written by Metaxas about Squanto that was in the Wall Street Journal, but Eric Metaxas. But the point is that it's a true story about evil that befell an individual at the hands of other human beings. And the evil, it became clear, was used by God providentially to bring good to the Mayflower community, and to save that initial group of Puritans there that began then to populate New England, and Squanto was critical in that. And so we can see, yes, it appears God allowed this adversity to happen at the hands of men to accomplish a greater purpose. And so looking back on it now, we can see that. Now, God does that with human beings. He does it with Satan, too. Does Satan have access to cause things to happen? If he doesn't have access to cause things to happen, I don't know how he does anything that he does. The debate that I have heard about, people have raised, is the debate about whether he can put thoughts into our mind. And I said, well, he's a tempter. How does he tempt us? Well, he could be responsible for having the pretty girl walk in front of us, and then the pretty girl's the thing that tempts us, and that's how he uses the circumstances. But see, even in that characterization, that minimalist kind of characterization, you have Satan somehow being involved in the pretty girl walking in front of the guy. So I don't see how he can have any effect on us if he can't have access to our world or even have access to our minds. Okay? I think he does both, in fact. When you look at here, I'm looking at 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4, starting in verse 3. Even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, in whose case the God of this world, who would that be?
It'd be Satan.
That would be Satan.
Has
blinded the minds of the unbelieving so that they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. There's Satan getting right into the heads of the non-believers. He blinds their minds. I think in the Gospels it says at one point that Satan put it in Judas's had a hard time getting to that one. Put it in Judas's mind to betray Christ. You know, so he got in their mind. It says in 1 John chapter 5 that the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. It says here in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24 and following, the Lord's bondservant, that would be you and I, must not be quarrelsome, shouldn't be out for a fight, but kind to all, able to teach, patient when wronged, with gentleness correcting those who are in opposition. To what end? And here's what he says. If perhaps God may grant them repentance, leading to a knowledge of the truth. In other words, he's praying that we act in a certain way, a nice way, we be nice, so that God might grant them the turning of their minds, leading them to the knowledge of the truth. Well, what's keeping them from the knowledge of the truth? Next verse. And they come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil, having been held captive by him to do his will. And so here we've got just another case where it's really clear that in order for people to become Christians, God works to rescue them from falsehood that they believe in, that they are captured by through the devil. And then they are given the ability to believe. And in Revelations 12, there's one other reference. I'm just running through these quickly to show you this.
So I think I don't have any issue with the Satan working with people's minds. I think going back to the example of my friend in the truck, and this is why the Job verse came up, is if God providentially allows, can Satan mess with the weather and mess with my truck's alternator?
Yes. In principle, yes. That doesn't mean your friend whose truck goes out of whack is justified in saying, well, the devil made it do this.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, so it's hard for us to know when that's a factor. But, you know, sometimes, you know what specified complexity is? It's like when a pattern kind of falls together that indicates intelligent design, a certain type of pattern. So if somebody threw a bunch of dice out with numbers on it, okay, a whole bunch of dice, let's say seven dice, and they're getting all these random numbers. But if in the next five throws, those seven numbers spelled out your home number your cell phone number, your work number, your fax number, you know, and your wife's cell phone number. Well, that's specification. That's complexity that's specified. And I mean, then you'd think, oh, wait a minute, something else is going on here, because that's not going to happen by chance. Sometimes I think the nature of the circumstances are such that one is justified in inferring from the circumstances some type of spiritual attack. I mean, everything seems to be going wrong, and it's tied to something spiritually significant. I do think Satan can do those things. I think it's obvious from Job that Satan can do those things. I'm not the kind of guy who finds a demon under every bush. But I am. When you look at somebody's life who is working hard to advance the gospel and is doing so successfully, and a series of mishaps befalls that person, I don't think it's a stretch of the imagination to see something spiritual going on here. In fact, Paul says we are not naive regarding Satan's schemes. And indeed, he talks about in Ephesians 6 that we should put on the full armor of God so that we can stand firm against the schemes of the devil. That means he's got strategies. He's got plays. He's got a playbook, and he initiates those things. He executes the plays. Well, how does he execute the plays? He executes them in the conditions of mankind and the circumstances that we run into. He takes circumstances, and I don't know how much he causes and how much he takes what's already there and kind of blows on like he blows on a fire and just aggravates things. But the mechanics and the details and the particulars of these things are things that we don't know. But I think the insight we are given from Job is that Satan has access like this, and the New Testament texts make it clear that he has access to our minds, and he can compel us to do things through deceiving us and through tempting us. And I think he has, excuse me, I think Paul makes reference to Satan preventing him from accomplishing some goal. I'm not sure where I read this. Maybe it's in Romans. But I think the reference is there where it actually says that Satan was preventing something for a season. Now, how do you prevent somebody from doing something? The only way you can prevent somebody from doing something, if that person is trying to do it, is to be putting obstacles in his way through the events of that person's life that keeps that person from accomplishing that goal. So I don't know why there would be much debate about this.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm having a mental flashback to something probably Kent Hanegraaff said years ago, where his argument was that if Satan, and maybe the question really is about what God has allowed Satan to do and what he hasn't allowed him to do, but Hanegraaff's idea was, well, if Satan could do all these physical things, then why wouldn't he have run around masquerading as a Christ or done this or that or thing? And so maybe the follow-up question to you then is, what has God allowed Satan to do at this point in time to us? Because it seems like if he could do those things, he'd be doing a whole lot more of it, but maybe not.
Well, I'm not sure I understand Hank's response. I have a lot of respect for him, but the way you've given it to me, I'm just going to have to disagree with it. To say that Satan can do, no, I guess to rephrase it, if we say that Satan can do all of these things, then why hasn't he done more of this? Well, I think he's doing quite a bit, frankly. The world is thick with false religion, okay? Absolutely thick with it. There is all kinds of foolishness that's going on in the world, that all the political correctness that we see just in this country is the relativism in this country, the inclusivism that's in some religious perspectives, the annihilationism that is starting to take over some people's view of hell. There are all kinds of things that are falsehoods that show me that he is completely active all over the place. You know, it seems like he's doing a lot. And if he's not doing more, it's only because God providentially has restrained him from that. Mm-hmm. But we're not just working from Job. We've got all kinds of information from the New Testament about the impact that Satan is having. And the reason I read those four passages, and the other one was Revelations chapter 12, I think in verse 9 or something like that, where it talks about him being the deceiver or something. And I think the biggest way here it says, the great dragon, the serpent of old, called the devil, who deceives the whole world. So it also describes him as, in the next verse, as the accuser of the brethren. He accuses them before God. So, you know, look, there's a lot of activity that he is free to accomplish, and I think we can see it all around us if we have eyes to see it. Again, that doesn't mean the person's carburetor didn't work simply because the devil was messing with it. But like I said, sometimes these circumstances fall together in too neat of a way to deny that there is some spiritual element to this thing. And so we are told to beware, to be on our guard, to persevere. 1 Peter chapter 5, your adversary, be of sober mind. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Well, people have said, oh, well, he's got no teeth. He can just growl. No, he can devour. And how does he devour? That means he has to have some kind of impact in the physical realm. And in our minds, to devour in a certain sense. And then Peter says, resist him, firm in your faith. Paul says in 2 Corinthians that even the devil disguises himself as an angel of light. So he shows up and he looks like something good to people. So I think we have good biblical justification to believe that Satan has a tremendous amount of capability and latitude to have a radical impact in this world. And not just in through the obvious things like the occult, people involved in the occult. No, I don't think his schemes are limited to that. I think his schemes there are all kinds of things that enable him to blind the minds of the unbelievers, like 2 Corinthians 4 says, or to hold the world captive to do his will, like 1 John 5 says. So to deceive, as Revelations 12 says. And so we've got, you know, I'm not this guy that's into the spiritual warfare stuff where I'm always binding and loosing and all of that stuff. I very rarely pray a prayer like that, because Jesus taught us to pray to ask the Father to deliver us from evil, or the evil one, depending how you translate that. And that's the way I pray. But I'm on the lookout for the schemes of the devil, and I think we can, in a certain sense, decipher them in certain circumstances. And then realize, you know, I think the devil's up to no good in this one, and I want to stand firm against it with the truth. I think Job isn't a good example of the devil having access to accomplish those things. That help?
All right.
All right, Jeff. Well, I appreciate the call, and I'm glad I had a chance to talk a little bit about that issue. And enjoy your summer there in Minnesota. I'll be up in that neck of the woods in 2 weeks, straight east of you, about an hour and a half, and a little north. Okay, let's take a break, and we'll come back with more on Stand to Reason.
It's hard to keep in mind all the facts and arguments you need to address tough topics. That's why STR has developed a series of quick reference guides on same-sex marriage, abortion, and tactics to help refresh your memory and encourage dialogue. These guides give you concise answers, all on a single 8.5 by 11 inch laminated card. They're a quick and easy way to gain useful knowledge about some of the most important issues facing Christians today. With these tools at your side to guide your thoughts and aid your memory, you'll engage critics with full confidence. You'll be fully equipped to answer objections with grace and clarity. Get your quick reference guides today by visiting the STR store at store.str.org or calling 800-2-REASON.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges awaiting our youth are immense. Are the students in your home, your church, or your youth group prepared for what lies ahead? Sadly, most Christian students are ill-prepared for an aggressive secular campus and culture. It's time to step up the training of our young people, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for our two-day Rethink Student Apologetics Conference. In September, we'll be in Orange County, California. In October, we'll be in Dallas, Texas. And we'll equip your students with a reason for the hope they have in Jesus. Go to RethinkApologetics.com and register today.
Hi, I'm Alan Schliemann. I have a secret that helps me keep my cool whenever I get hostile criticism. Find out what it is in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud. Look for it on iTunes or the bottom of the homepage at str.org.
Greg Kokel back at you here. Two reminders I want to offer you here, both happening in August and almost kind of back-to-back. And the first one, of course, is our cruise conference coming up August 6th through 13th. We are departing from Seattle. We've done this cruise before, by the way. It is a fabulous cruise. We have a sensational time. Everybody that goes on the cruise can't say enough about it. We have ports like Juneau, Alaska, Sitka, Alaska, Ketchikan, Alaska. We'll be in Victoria, B.C. We will also, of course, be going all the way up the inside passage to the Great Glacier Bay, and that's a high point of our time up. I think, if I recall last time, we kind of cruise all the way to Glacier Bay, and then on our way back, we work ourselves into ports. So the cruising time, we use some of that time for our conference, and J. Warner Wallace from Cold Case Christianity and John Stone Street from the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview will be my partners, the three of us, teaching for you during that time. And of course, even though we have teaching conference time during the cruise time, there's still lots of time during the cruise time where you sit and relax and enjoy the cruise and do what you want on board ship. Hang out with us, have meals with us. Of course, we do that all the time. And it's just a fabulous way of getting together for teaching, for fellowship, and enjoying the beautiful scenery of the Inside Passage. That's August 6th through 13th. And if you want to get more information on that, contact Inspiration Cruises, 800-247-1899. 800-247-1899. Or just go on the online to Inspiration Cruises. That would be plural. InspirationCruises.com/STR. Let's see, less than 3 months to go before that. We're looking forward to it. We hope you can join us. And the week afterwards, Cross-Examine Instructors Academy is actually, it has been the last 8 years on the East Coast in Charlotte. This year it's going to be West Coast. So if you haven't been able to make the long trip and you want to be involved in like a 3 or 3.5 day intensive training with people like Frank Turek and Brett Kunkel and myself and, you know, a whole bunch of other people that I think Sean McDowell might be involved this year and a whole bunch. I don't have all the name of the list of folks, but these are accomplished people that are meant to help train you to be a better communicator as an apologist. And if you've kind of dabbled in some of this before and done some communication, you want to get much better, we'll teach you some of the skills, the content and the delivery skills to accomplish this. And here in beautiful Southern California, no less. And we don't have the high humidity that they have out there in Charlotte. So it's a lot nicer here, and you'll enjoy that. And that's going to be August 18th through 20th. And there's really no reason you can't do both. You can take the Alaska cruise, and you can do CIA, because I'm going to do both. I'll be at both of them. I'll be one of the instructors there. August 18th through 20th, crossexamined.org is the place to go for all the information of Cross Examined Instructors Academy 2016. So check it out. All right, let's go back to the phones. And I'm going to do my best at pronunciation here. Vivia.
Mariah.
Oh, Mariah. Okay. All right, sorry, my error. Mariah, glad to have you on board. Is it like from the song and they called the Winds
it is,
Mariah?
Yeah, from Genesis.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah, I actually met you. My husband and I met you a couple weekends ago in Bonneville.
No kidding. Bonneville in Alberta.
Yeah.
Oh, well, wonderful. Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to talk to you in person.
Well, it's just you and I on the phone. You know, nobody else is listening. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to find a church that is doctrinally sound and struggling a couple of the last weekends. And Sunday school, my daughter has been going through these Old Testament stories and just kind of surprising how they present them to, she's four, and her class of 4 and 5-year-olds, they've been learning, last week was about how the fire rained down and took up the offering in front of the prophets of Baal, and then this week was on 2 Kings 19, on basically, she came home saying the angels, well, she actually said in front of the Sunday school teacher to my husband that the angels killed the people, and the Sunday school teacher said, yes, God did it. And that's what my daughter took away from it.
Uh-huh. This was the army. Was this the army that Elijah and his servant beheld?
Yeah, and he was praying Hezekiah's prayer is what they focused on. And it's the Assyrians, I believe. And anyways, what her takeaway, which seemed okay to the Sunday school teacher right in front of her, was that the angels killed them, that God killed these people. And just so nonchalantly about it that we're just concerned. And so I just thought I'd hear your perspective on it.
Well, I'm just thinking if I were teaching my 4-year-old, I don't know if I would go to a passage like that for a 4-year-old. Because these aren't, the way you characterize it is Bible stories, and that's a standard way of putting it. But of course, you know, these aren't stories. These are actual events that took place. Mm-hmm. These are accounts. Pardon me, and this is the trouble with it. When we have the accounts of judgment by God, and we convey these to children who are of an age that they're not really best equipped to manage that, to understand what's going on, that there could be a moral justification for God's action here. Then it might cause fright and confusion. I mean, think about the incident where the kids are talking, I think, to Elisha here and calling him Baldy, 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 okay?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Then the bears come out of the woods and maul the children to death.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, this is a hard one, I think, even for adults to understand, to make sense of. What's going on there? How could God be involved with that? But for people, not that this was the account, but I'm just giving this as an example. If you give that to a child, can you imagine what the child is going to think? Is the child capable of drawing the right lesson from that material?
Right.
And so
the way my husband, he came away being upset about it, that it's almost like they're just surface level teaching the concepts and the events, and then really, is that going to confuse them on the nature of God? Because, like you said, they won't know the full reasons and the full story, the full account. So,
well, I'm thinking. Well, this could be a concern. I don't know what else they're teaching at the Sunday school, and this may simply reflect a lack of skill of that Sunday school teacher, not necessarily a problem with the entire church.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to tell. I'm thinking of, like I mentioned a moment ago, my own children. I don't know that I would have related this story quite like this with any detail to Eva when she was 4. However, when Annabeth was 4, I think she was at a different place and much more mentally, emotionally capable of managing this. I mean, she read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which has its gruesome moments, when she was 5.
Well,
And there you have the sacrificial atonement characterized in the death of Aslan at the hands of the witch. That didn't seem to trouble her, all of that material became fodder for conversation about real spiritual things. If I were giving the account from the 2 Kings 19, I would just simply make the point that the armies of God's enemies were arrayed against his prophet, his people, and God saved them.
Right.
God went out and saved them by destroying the armies.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be kind of a general way of putting it. What do you mean destroying? That means killing the people? Well, yeah, but you know, there are different ways to put it. You can just talk about
this. Well, and to highlight the rescue from God rather than at their age, they can't absorb every single thing.
Correct.
So I would have come at it that, you know, God rescued
right,
his people.
Right.
And
now, there is an element, though, about certainly the wrath of God and the anger of God and the judgment of God and the holiness of God and all of that stuff that has a place. But I think four
right.
years old is maybe a little bit young to give very much detail regarding that. I think we should communicate something about that. But the accounts that give vivid characterizations of this kind of thing, or the imprecatory psalms where you see David saying, I wish I could take their children and dash their skulls against the rocks, you know, and, well, that's probably a bit much for a four-year-old, you know. That's
right.
A bit much for adults, too, trying to figure out all what that's about. My general approach is I think it's good to teach all about God. The full spectrum, you know, the good and the bad from our perspective, his holiness, mm-hmm. judgment, and his grace and his mercy in age-appropriate ways. So we don't want to – I know what they usually start with in Vacation Bible School, love, love, love. It sounds like a John Lennon song or something. All we
yeah.
need is love. It's everything's love, and it's all the love of God for you. And very little emphasis played on the sin. I feel sometimes a little uncomfortable with that because it seems
yeah.
to me you should get a little bit of a balance. It's not all about God loving you and you're wonderful. You're not wonderful. You're awful before God,
yeah.
and this is why you need a Savior. So I was actually stunned once, Mariah, when I went to the New Testament, the book of Acts, and I went through the book of Acts just to see how the gospel was communicated there. And I did not find a single time of the 13 times the gospel is communicated, preached to groups or individuals, where the love of God was invoked at all. It was all these kind of ugly images like, you know, Jesus is going to come to judge, and he who believes in him is rescued.
Yep.
But the love of God is never mentioned in any of those preachments in the book of Acts by the very people Jesus personally trained to follow after him.
Right.
So, love of God's in the Bible, of course, and so this is part of the story. We need to communicate with them, but I think we have to give a balance, too. But we have
yeah.
to give a balance in a way that they can, that's age-appropriate, whether they're 4 or 14, okay? Mariah, there's our music. That's the end of the show. Thank you so much for the call, and it's nice to chat with you again. Say hi to the crowd. Way up there in Alberta, northern Alberta. Great talking with you. That's it for our show, my friends. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. You give them heaven this week, all right? Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.